This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody. I hope everybody had a great week. Did you have a good week?
So far, so good.
Are you ready for today's story?
Yes.
Today's story was requested by a mutual friend of ours. Her name is Teresa.
Hey, Teresa.
Love her to death. This happened right near her house, and it's a very important story to her. And after researching a lot, it's now a very important story to me. I got a lot of my information from web sleuths, believe it or not. I also reached out to a family member to confirm some of the questions I had. So that being said and done, are you ready for the story?
Absolutely.
On Saturday, August 19th in 2017, William Van Gelderen went to his parents' house to give medicine to his family's 21-year-old cat, Jessie. His parents lived in the Druid Hills area of Atlanta, Georgia, near Emory College. Do you know where that is?
No.
And his 25-year-old sister, Jenna, she'd been house-sitting there while their parents were on vacation in Canada. She'd been there about 3 days, and her sole purpose for staying there was to take care of the elderly cat, Jessie. Jessie, being old, had a lot of health problems and needed medicine injected multiple times throughout the day. But Jenna wasn't comfortable injecting him with meds. As a result, her brother, William, he would go there, and also a vet tech would come over to help out. That morning, William called his sister around 9:30, but she didn't answer. He went to his parents' two-story brick home about an hour later, and when he got there, Jenna's 2010 dark blue Mazda was gone. All the doors to the house were locked, so he used his key to get inside. And one of the locks was a deadbolt, so it had to be locked from the outside. He was surprised when he got inside to find the television and the lights were still on. Jenna had obviously had some friends over in the days prior, as evidenced by the mess that was left behind in some of the rooms. But what was really surprising to William was that the cat, Jessie, clearly hadn't been fed, which didn't make any sense to him because when it came to Jessie, Jenna was very responsible. She loved that cat. After giving the cat its medicine and some food, William left. A vet tech came by later that day to administer another injection to Jessie, but when the vet tech came there, she couldn't get in because the doors were locked. She tried to call Jenna, and Jenna had told her family she was going to be there all weekend. When she phoned Jenna, Jenna didn't answer. William was out of town at a wedding for the day. He was able to make it back over to his parents' house at around 11 p.m. that night, and when he did, Jenna still wasn't there, and it didn't look like she'd been back. That's when he started noticing some strange things. Jenna's tennis shoes that she wore every day were still there, and her green phone charger was plugged in and sitting on top of the end table in the living room. Maybe these things wouldn't immediately be a concern for you, but you see, Jenna had been diagnosed a year earlier with high-functioning autism. That made her more susceptible and more vulnerable to all the dangers that we know lurk in the world. As a child, her parents were told she had a learning disability. Throughout her childhood, she frequently asked a lot of questions, more than most kids. Like, she really needed clarification on things. And because of this, many kids her age found her to be somewhat annoying. So she didn't have a lot of friends.
Kids can be cruel.
Absolutely. I'm sure I was. I don't like to think I was, but I probably was. I was probably an ass. Even though she had high-functioning autism, in 2016, Jenna earned a certificate in office administration from Gwinnett Technical College. As a young adult, her autism affected her interactions with others. She's described as being very impressionable, gullible, which sometimes led to people taking advantage of her and manipulating her into doing things that she would otherwise never do. and I'll circle back to this. So Saturday night, Will checks in at 11:30 at his parents' house and he leaves. The next morning, William came back to his parents' house, and that's when he noticed some things he'd missed the day before. For years, the family had this framed 5-foot by 2-foot tapestry with Egyptian imagery on their wall. The tapestry was a quilt-like cloth and it was heavy. So it's been described as a tapestry, but my understanding is more like a quilt. It had been purchased by Jenna and William's grandfather in the 1940s around World War II when he was in Egypt. The tapestry was actually a buffet covering, and it was part of a 3-piece set which included 2 tablecloths, but they weren't framed. The buffet covering hung in the family living room in this glass and wooden frame. William noticed the frame was still on the wall, but the buffet covering itself had been removed from it. Someone had broken the bottom right corner of the glass, not the entire glass, just the corner, and removed the tapestry. Normally, to access this buffet covering, you would remove the wooden back of it, but to do this, you would need to get some tools. So instead, someone just broke the corner and pulled the buffet cover out. Then it looks like the glass was cleaned and hung back on the wall. And I'll have a picture of this tapestry and the frame on our website, but it's massive. It's 5 feet. What's really interesting is the buffet covering wasn't valuable. Others like it could be purchased on eBay for just a couple $100s. It didn't make any sense to William because there were TVs and other more valuable items still in the home. He called his parents, Roseanne and Leon, who were in Canada, and together they agreed to file a missing persons report. When the officer came to William and Jenna's parents' house to make the report, he did a quick walkthrough of the house, he made the report, and he left. It seemed to him that Jenna, who was 25 years old at the time, left on her own. But Jenna's family knew better. Her parents called the police from Canada and begged them to do some forensic testing of the house, maybe try to get some fingerprints. But the DeKalb police refused. Roseanne and Leon cut short their trip, and they made it home by that Monday. So it's August 21st of 2017. Not long after arriving home, Jenna's father, Leon, noticed that the suitcase Jenna had brought with her to house it was missing from the home. But even more odd is what was found left behind in the house. Besides her shoes and her cell phone charger, Jenna's makeup and toiletries were found in a plastic Kroger grocery bag on the bathroom counter. Most women, I know myself included, who plan on going somewhere for a while, they're going to take their makeup and they're going to take their toiletries.
Definitely.
But to those who are just looking at the bag, it would appear to be a garbage bag. And I saw a picture of it. I would have assumed it's a garbage bag taken from the bathroom garbage and placed on there. This led her family to believe that their house was staged by someone who wanted to make it look like Jenna left on her own. Her parents also noticed there were items left by Jenna's friends who'd apparently been over on Thursday night before she disappeared. They know that Jenna had at least 2, if not more, people over that night. One of them was a newer friend named Bailey, who'd been staying with Jenna at her parents' since pretty much as soon as her parents left town. By this point, most families would probably be alarmed, but with the Van Gelderens, they were especially concerned for Jenna's safety. Jenna's high-functioning autism and lack of friends in her childhood made her crave friendships as an adult. In the past year, she'd been hanging around some less than desirable people, and her family found out in April of that year that at least one of them had very dubious intentions. For 3 years, Jenna had worked at Pet Supply Plus because she just loved animals. But all that ended in April of 2017, 4 months prior to her disappearance. She got caught stealing $3,000 from the store, which ended up resulting in a misdemeanor for her. A former coworker of Jenna's at the Pet Supply Plus store, he made an internet post in which she said she was a very generous and overly helpful person at the store. He said, quote, "One of our male coworkers would take advantage of her generosity, from constantly getting rides from her, borrowing money, and using her as a friend with benefits," end quote. I can't confirm this, but that was on the internet. Her parents later discovered that Jenna had been manipulated, or maybe even extorted, into stealing money from the pet supply store by a man she met a few years earlier at Gwinnett Tech. Listen to this. She would Western Union him small increments of money at a time, such as $70, $115, $120, totaling over $1,100. But these payments to this man stopped around the time she got fired. Her family still doesn't know the full connection to this man and her life, and why she would do that for him. After she got fired from the pet store, she nannied and babysat part-time to earn money. When her parents found out about her stealing, they became extremely concerned about the group of friends that Jenna had started hanging out with that year. They didn't believe that they had Jenna's best interest at heart, and they told her so. Some of them had criminal records, they liked to party, drink, smoke weed, and some of them were from really bad neighborhoods. Which, again, may not seem like a big deal for a typical 25-year-old, but when you couple that with Jenna's ability to be easily manipulated, it's really concerning. At the time of the Pet Supply Plus incident, Jenna had a T-Mobile iPhone. That was on her parents' family plan. This allowed her father, Leon, to have access to her phone activities. He noticed she was still talking to people that weren't a good influence for her, and he confronted her about that. As a result, Jenna became very upset, and she moved out of her parents' house and into a room of a man who was renting an apartment. She refused to tell her parents where she lived.
So she was like subletting?
Yes.
Okay.
Only that she was couch hopping because she felt they were too judgmental and wouldn't approve. So they didn't even know she had her own room at the time with a man who was renting an apartment. In addition, she got a second phone that she didn't tell her parents about. She registered the Metro PCS phone under the name Ruth Jenna. Ruth is her middle name. That way, since her father doesn't even know about the phone, he can't track her activities. The Metro PCS phone was one of those prepaid phones that you don't need to have a credit check or proof of identity. It's like a burner phone.
Mm-hmm.
That's my understanding. And I don't want to misconstrue Jenna's relationship with her parents at this point in her life. She still loved them very much. She spoke to her mom daily. But she really wanted the independence and freedom. She's 25. And she deemed her parents to just be very critical of her friends.
Well, they're probably overprotective too, right?
Yes, that's how she described them.
Yeah, it's understandable.
Days went by with no word from Jenna. Her family found out that on the day Jenna disappeared, she'd been driving around in her mother's red Mazda 3 car because the insurance lapsed on Jenna's Mazda 6. When they looked in the car, they noticed the passenger seat was pulled all the way back as if someone very tall had sat there. And there was also a Wendy's paper straw covering on the passenger side of the floor. Leon and Roseanne asked the police to fingerprint the car, but they refused. The Van Gelderens couldn't access Jenna's second Metro PCS phone, but they were able to get the contacts from the T-Mobile iPhone on Leon's account. And they called up all of her contacts, even her new friends, asking if anybody knew any information about Jenna. Through one of her new friends, they were able to find out the location of the room Jenna rented. It was on Lenox Street in Lenox Woods Apartments, which is about 3 miles or 11 minutes northwest of her parents' home. They made contact with Jenna's roommate, asking him if they could look at her bedroom, but he told them no. He did tell them that her rent was paid up until August 31st, but on September 1st, he was going to throw all of her stuff out. Obviously, he wasn't too concerned about her. Her friends also told him that Jenna had a man who was her quote-unquote boyfriend, and I use that term lightly. According to one friend, this man had driven Jenna's car before and had been to her parents' house. The Van Gelderens called this man up, and he told them he didn't see Jenna on the Friday night she disappeared, and he spent the night alone. The Van Gelderens gave this information, along with the items left by her friends at their house, to the DeKalb County Police Department, who agreed to go and speak to both Jenna's roommate and the boyfriendish man. Her boyfriend told them that on the night Jenna disappeared, she showed up at his house randomly, and they got into a disagreement because he found out she was selling her body for money and was a drug addict, and he told her he didn't want to see her anymore.
What?
This is different than what he told her family. This statement pivoted the entire direction of the case with the DeKalb police. Why they believed a boyfriend that said he just broke up with a missing woman, to this day we don't know. But eventually he quit cooperating and lawyered up. The DeKalb police released a statement to the public in which they incorrectly stated that Jenna's brother William had told them she was a prostitute.
Oh, man.
In addition, they said Jenna had a history of disappearing for days at a time. None of this was true. After the comments were made to the public about Jenna being a sex worker, a woman contacted the police and said they'd found a woman named Jenna who looked like Jenna on the now defunct website Backpage. For those that don't know what Backpage is, it is a website that was used by sex workers and human traffickers to place ads for sex. The police contacted the Van Gelderens and told them they found Jenna selling her body online. However, the next day, the Jenna from the back page was brought into the station, and of course, it wasn't Jenna Van Gelderen. And I'm pretty sure most of the people that had posted on Backpage didn't use
their real names. Yeah, no kidding.
The police eventually went to Jenna's apartment and spoke with her male roommate. He told them he was just getting ready to throw her stuff out. So instead of throwing it out, he gave her property to the police to give to the family. There were basically just a few bags of clothes. Some noticeable items that were missing, though, were bedding. There's no mattress, there's no blankets, there's no pillows. The roommate told the police that Jenna didn't have a bed. She slept on the floor with no bedding.
Come on, really?
However, one friend claimed to her family that there was a mattress in the bedroom. But last I knew, it hadn't been verified. This sort of information shouldn't be difficult to ascertain. Does she have a bed there or does she not? But yet, the family struggles for answers for most of this. Had the police taken Jenna's disappearance seriously in the beginning, many regrettable mistakes could have been prevented. But they didn't. The family was basically left to find Jenna on their own. They made a webpage called Help Find Jenna Van Gelderen, Help Find Jenna VG. On it, they posted a picture of Jenna's missing dark blue Mazda 6. 2 weeks later, so this is September 5th, a woman was on her way to the gym and she'd seen that Facebook post. She recognized Jenna's car while she was driving to the gym on the side of the road. It was parked on the side of DeFore Place Northwest Road in Northwest Atlanta, about 7 miles from her parents' house. The area is described as up and coming, but spotty. There's a rap studio called Street Execs across the street from where her car was, and there's apartments just down the road. There's also an events venue called Dynasty. When they found her car, it was dirty, it was covered with leaves and debris, and the keys were missing. To this day, no one can say for sure how long it was parked on that street. The doors were unlocked, it was low on gas, and the driver's seat had been pushed back as far and as low as it could go. Jenna, who's only 4'11", could not have possibly drove the car that way. In the back seat of her Mazda was the missing suitcase she had brought to her parents' house, with some of her clothes strewn around the back seat, but most of the clothes were in the unzipped suitcase. They also found her ID and her debit card and her glasses. In addition, an unidentified person's shoes and phone charger that didn't match either of Jenna's was in the car. But neither of Jenna's two cell phones were in it. There was no immediate sign of foul play, like blood or anything of that nature, found in the car. The police towed the car and looked through it, but because they didn't see any signs of foul play, they released the car to her parents, whom, by the way, they charged for the towing fees. It took about 4 months for the police to really take her disappearance seriously and do a complete forensic analysis of the vehicle.
That's really sad to me.
In the interim, the family hired a private investigator to do some digging, which is how we learned a lot about her friends and their criminal backgrounds. Also, her brother William knew Jenna's passwords, so he was able to access some of Jenna's Google accounts and social media accounts. He found a plethora of information, and some of it very unsettling, and handed it over to the police. The police informed him that the information was obtained illegally, so therefore, since Jenna didn't give consent, they couldn't really use it, and they would have to figure out how to get it on their own.
Really?
Really. Does it make your blood boil?
Yes. family's privacy laws.
One of the things her family discovered in accessing her information was that she had downloaded at least 10 different messaging apps in the year prior to her disappearance. So Google Hangouts is a big one, but she also had one called Text Me Up. And like I said, a lot of them were very small apps and they didn't save any of the information of her activities.
So it was like once you use it, it disappears?
Yes. The family was able to make a timeline of Jenna's activities on the night she disappeared based on phone records and Google Maps from the T-Mobile phone and also debit card transactions. So this is what they were able to piece together. On the Friday night she disappeared, she was hanging out with her friend Bailey at her parents' house. Around 8:30 p.m., a male friend of Jenna's made plans with her to get something to eat. He lived on the south side of Atlanta in an area called College Park. He told Jenna that she shouldn't drive her mother's red Mazda 3 there because it wasn't safe. And when I Googled College Park on Wikipedia, it described it as, quote, a nightmarish southern ghetto, end quote.
No.
But I don't know. I've never been there. It could be lovely. I don't know. Instead of driving to College Park, the two arranged to meet at a restaurant closer to Jenna's apartment. Not her parents' house, but her apartment. Prior to leaving to meet him, Jenna had on her favorite green San Antonio jersey that her dad had given to her. She pretty much wore it all week. According to her friend, before she went out, she took off the green San Antonio jersey. She put on some black leggings and a black spaghetti strap shirt. The green San Antonio t-shirt was later found inside her car. Bailey didn't want to go out with her, so instead she called an Uber to pick her up from Jenna's parents' house and take her home. I don't know why Jenna didn't give her a ride, but we'll move on. Both young women left the house around 9 p.m. Jenna went to a gas station and then to her apartment. At her apartment, there were some friends there. She hung out for a little while. Then she went to a Texaco gas station. From there, she hit another gas station and she was driving her mom's red Mazda, not her car. Then went back to her apartment again, but only for a few minutes. At some point, she picked up some Wendy's food. She spoke to her friend Stacy, who lived in South Carolina, at around 10:30. And it's on some app that's recorded, so that's how they have all the information about that conversation. She told Stacy of her plans for the evening, which I believe included meeting up with her supposed boyfriend. They had been arguing. He was using someone else's phone and he contacted Jenna, suggesting they meet up at a gas station, which she did around 11:30. Google Map records show she stayed at that gas station and it's in the area of English Avenue, for those that know Atlanta, by North and Northside Drive. She stayed there for about 6 minutes. And this is really important because her quote-unquote boyfriend originally told the family he didn't see her, then said she randomly showed up at his house, but now we have him meeting her at a gas station. He's the last person we know to see her alive. From what I know about this man, and I could be wrong, he's about 33 at the time, 6 feet tall, he worked in security, and probably met Jenna at the Pet Supply Plus store. But information on him is scarce. As I mentioned earlier, he's the only one that told the police she was a prostitute and a drug addict. After that, Google Maps shows nothing on her secret second phone. So it either died or it was shut off. However, on her other phone, at 11:50 p.m. that evening, she has 2 missed calls from the friend that was supposed to meet her for food. She also has a 2-minute butt dial from him where you can hear loud music and mumble conversation in the background. This particular friend had a lot of social media posts about pimping and clubbing. But I don't know if the pimping is just him trying to seem like a badass.
Right.
And maybe he just wasn't a classy guy. I mean, I don't know a lot about pimping. I don't know if they post on Instagram.
I would think not, because it's an illegal activity. So I would think maybe he's showboating a little. Maybe,
right,
like,
exactly.
Yeah.
And again, he says she never showed up at the location they were supposed to meet at. According to Jenna's Facebook records, someone logged into her Facebook account from her parents' home, probably around 1:30 in the morning. So what we know is at 11:30 she's at a gas station. Her Google Maps is off now. And at 1:30, someone is at her parents' house and went on Facebook, but didn't type anything. Did she go back to her parents' house alone? No one knows. At 2:15 a.m., Stacy in South Carolina, who had spoken to her earlier, received a random text from Jenna that said, quote, laying down. Although they're just two simple words, it didn't seem like anything Jenna would have sent. And there's been no phone activity on either phone since then. Through Jenna's Google Hangout account, her family was able to discover that someone had been pressuring Jenna that night to leave her parents' house and come back to the apartment. But Google Hangouts doesn't show who wrote the messages, and it's still unknown to the family this day. So some months go by. In October, about 2 months after her disappearance, her friend Bailey called the police to report that she thought she saw Jenna at the Publix grocery store in Atlanta. She even wrote down the license plate of the car the girl was seen getting out of and went inside to try to find her, but she said she was running late for work and gave up. The police tracked the license plate down immediately. They found the vehicle was registered to a female college student at Emory College, which was right nearby Jenna's parents' house. And the girl driving the car didn't resemble Jenna, but she was wearing a green t-shirt. So it was deemed a false sighting. Through phone records, the police and family learned where Jenna's T-Mobile known phone was last pinged. But before I tell you about her phone being pinged, we're going to take a quick break. So as I said, phone records were able to establish the area where her phone was last pinged at 7:15 in the morning and at 7:45 in the morning on Saturday in the Fairburn area of Georgia. On the morning she went missing, her phone pinged. Someone called her, and that's how they were able to get the ping. This is months later, though.
Right.
4 months later.
That they find this out.
Yes. I believe you can get phone records much quicker than that, but we'll move on. Fairburn is about 30 miles from her parents' house. That area is remote. It's with a lot of dense wooding, multiple ponds, and a massive landfill. The phone ping narrowed the search location to a few hundred acres. And if you saw a satellite picture of it, you'd realize it's massively wooded, dense area, and a few hundred acres is a lot to go through. This area was described by one of the investigators on the TV show Oxygen, who discussed this case, and I got some information from it, as a perfect area to dump a body. In addition, there was a waste management transfer station in the area. And on the Saturday morning after Jenna disappeared, trucks were scheduled to pick up dumpsters filled with garbage and take them to a landfill in Griffin, Georgia. Interestingly, at the same time her phone pinged at 7:15 a.m., her car license plate was recognized by a system that can pick up license plate numbers. It was recognized being miles away from that area at the exact same time. So there's no doubt in anybody's mind that her car was being driven far away from where her phone was at 7:15 in the morning. They were in two separate places. At this point, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, the GBI, they got involved in the case. Forensic analysis of Jenna's parents' house, her mother's car, and her car were inconclusive. In communicating with her brother, he said he didn't have any of the answers to anything that they found, or else it was inconclusive. Search teams made up of Jenna's friends and family and investigators have searched that area where her phone was last pinged and found no clues to Jenna's whereabouts. Her family ended up hiring two private investigators, and they know that Jenna was supposed to meet up with at least two men who claimed she never showed. But what does the roommate know? What does her boyfriend know? What do her friends that stayed at her parents' house know? What about the people that were hanging out at her apartment that night she stopped by? What do they know? Someone, Tanya, knows something.
They have to.
And they're not telling.
So why?
Those of you out there that know the people I'm talking about, you need to put pressure on them to come forward and speak to the GBI. I'm a huge fan of law enforcement, but I'm not a real big fan of DeKalb Police Department with this case. Had they taken it seriously in the beginning, we would probably know what happened to Jenna. There are so many things I didn't even mention to our listeners about how they dropped the ball because I just don't want to go down that path. But the family now has so many unanswered questions and they really need closure. Authorities need to step up the plate. And because I believe in this day and age with our ability to track phones, CCTVs everywhere on every corner, that the answers lie somewhere in their file. If you have any tips you want to share, you can do it anonymously. You can call 404-577-TIPS. That's Crime Stoppers. I believe there's a $50,000 reward. You can also go to our friends and family Facebook and Twitter page. It's with the handle HelpFindJennaVG. You can do a hashtag JennaCase on Twitter and find out more. And I'll have all these links on our website. Jenna's described as being 4'11", around 140 pounds. She's got long, sort of wavy black hair and a Star of David tattoo on her upper thigh. So if anybody recognizes that tattoo, please again, call the tip line that I gave you. There are a lot of theories about what happened to Jenna. Some people think that she may be a victim of sex trafficking. Some people argue that she left on her own. I don't believe that. I don't believe she would have left the cat she was very attached to. And again, without her toiletries, she didn't have any money. There were no secret bank accounts out there, so she didn't have any money. And if she left, you would think after all this time, one of her friends, someone would have came forward. And again, she had high-functioning autism. So say she even did leave on her own. She's still endangered.
Right, and what would be the motive to leave and just disappear?
I know she left her family. Some people, of course, think that she was murdered and put in the landfill. But the reality is none of us really know what happened to Jenna, and she may very well still be out there. That is the mystery of Jenna Van Gelderen's disappearance.
I have so many questions too now.
Lots of questions. I read through almost 1,000 posts on Web Sleuth. Found all the information I could. There's a lot of misinformation out there, but that's all we know.
That's heartbreaking.
It really is.
That you have a family member disappear and you have so many questions. I can't imagine what her family is going through because I would be completely heartbroken.
And not really having the police take it seriously for a while.
That must have been infuriating.
It's very upsetting. Someone out there knows something, and this case is solvable. So we need to find Jenna. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, everyone.
You guys should really go to our website, and I have pictures of Jenna's car. I have pictures of the tapestry. What was that with the tapestry?
I know. I was thinking, why did they take the tapestry? What was the purpose of that?
Maybe it was a red herring to throw people off.
That their house got robbed or something. But like William said, there was valuables still in the house. So
I don't know why the tapestry was taken.
Just weird.
Her phones have never been found. So you can go to our website, tntcrimes.com, because I'm Talia and she's Tanya and we're TNT. And you can see pictures of her car, pictures of Jenna. I have maps. I have lots of information and links to other information on Jenna. You can also help support us by going to patreon.com/TNT Crimes. And we have lots of episodes there. I recently did one that's coming out soon that's never been done before about a Navy woman. And there's some necrophilia involved.
That was a rough episode.
That was very rough. You can go to our Instagram and our Facebook at TNT Crimes Podcast. Our Twitter at TNT Crimes Pod. Before we go, one more thing. Got to give a shout out to my friend Nikki from Nikki Podcast Preparations. He and I go bounce back and forth. He's a consultant and he's amazing. As he says, his services are cheaper than milk. So if you're trying to have your own podcast and you need some help, go to allmylinks.com/NikkiPPInc. He's amazing. Anything else?
Not that I can think of.
Thanks, everybody, again, for listening. Stay safe. Don't kill each other.
Until next time.
Bye.
Bye.